Well, I'm lucky to still own my very first motorcycle. It's lying in South Africa. I had to bring it. It was a Gareli. It's called a Gareli. And they called it a monkey bike those days, but it was a little bit bigger than the monkey bikes. And I was roughly 5 years old when my dad put me on it, because he used to have to look after me on a Saturday morning. My mother wanted a break. And he worked in a dealership. So he put me on this thing, kicked it in gear, couldn't touch the floor. And then I would just idle and putt around the dealership. So one day I decided, well, if I pull this lever up, I'm going to get another gear and I can go a little faster. And I did. And it flew forward into a car. And then I got, you know, those were still the days when you had disciplined kids because you whacked the shit out of it.
Yeah.
He first checked the car, saw everything else, and thought I was still alive. And not, and then he beat me up worse than what the bloody car.
Welcome to Oil and Whiskey, an Ironclad original. I am Josh Henning.
I'm Phil Gerber.
I'm Jeremy Gerber.
Today's guest is owner of Superformance LLC, Lance Stander. Welcome to Oil and Whiskey, an Ironclad original.
Hi, guys. I'm looking forward to it.
Good, man. How about you? How's it been going? Are you in California? Are you in Florida? Are you in South Africa? I mean, you're a man of travel. So where are you at right now?
No, I'm sitting in Florida, and that's where I'm most of the time at the moment.
Can't complain
rough
about
life.
The weather there.
Yeah.
Rough life.
Had a bit of a rainstorm earlier, but otherwise it's always Florida sunshine. Nothing wrong with that.
Beautiful.
So what have you been working on today? What is a day in Lance's life today look like? What have you been working on?
Okay, so today was a more exciting day for me. I actually got a new boat, so I was messing around on the boat today, not working with cars or anything like that.
You got to do that. We just had a boat guest on last week, Randy Schism, who owns MTI Powerboats.
I've heard of him. Don't know him.
So tell us about the new boat. We're boat guys, so.
Yeah, are you boat guys too? No, I love the boat. We've waited many, many years to get something this size. You know, in California, we couldn't get a slip. We were on waiting lists for up to 14 years to get a slip for a bigger than 40-foot boat where we were in Orange County. But at least in Florida, you can. So I just got a new Riviera 4600. It's a lovely boat. It's really
beautiful.
Supposed to be heading to Bahamas and on the weekend, but long story short, we're actually going to go with a friend's boat instead, because people that were supposed to go with them can't go, and you need to be at least four on a boat when you're pulling a tender and a whole lot of stuff and moving around. So my new boat will be resting in the slip, which is probably not a bad thing.
It's always
wear out these boats.
Always better going boating when it's on somebody else's boat anyway. So
yeah.
you know it's funny, in California, so you have to wait 14 years for a slip, but if you've got a 40-foot trailer, like a trailer home, you could park that anywhere you want.
Yeah, right
on the side of the road.
In front of somebody's business, anywhere, if you wanted to.
That is true. That is true about California. But now boats, it's a whole different story.
Awesome, man. So we've all been a big fan of Superformance. It's a very, very interesting company. Something that we admire, the business model and what you guys do. I mean, we've recently kind of branched out into, we've always done custom cars, very exclusive stuff. We got a few things that are a little bit more high production for us. When I say high production, I'm talking like, 10, 15. Those are,
It's like your weekend production, maybe.
Yeah.
But a very interesting business model that you've got. So where did that all get started? You stepped in and purchased Superformance? Are you with it from the get-go? How does take us way back to the beginning of that process?
Yeah, well, way back when I was still in South Africa, I'd actually owned one of the Superformance Cobras and had used the factory, which is called High Tech in South Africa, that assembled the Cobras then. But they'd built very few. They'd built approximately 60 cars by then, way back then. And I was bringing American cars to South Africa. We disassemble them in America, bring them in under SKD and CKD, slightly knocked down or completely knocked down. And it was a way of saving duties into South Africa. And then High Tech would reassemble. They did two Vipers for me and a Camaro, a couple of Camaros, and even Chevy Lumina minivans and stuff like that. And that's how I knew of it. Then we came to America, And I was actually in the salvage business in South Africa. I had 13 salvage pools around South Africa, and that was my main business. And I'd come to America to start getting involved in the salvage business. Well, I was in for a big, big surprise. What was $1 million business in South Africa is $1 billion business in America.
Sure.
And they were going to kick this little white African's ass. There's no way he got into this massive industry. And so, you know, funny, we knew of these guys doing the Cobras from South Africa in America. And my wife said, well, look, I got to do something. I'm sitting around and you're not getting a business going. And we've always worked. She's worked since she was 14 or something. And so she's going to do the Cobras. So I went and met the guys. They were ex-South Africans living in Ohio. And we started a little Cobra shop in Bristol Street, opposite, close to the airport. And eventually I kept hitting my head against a brick wall, trying to get the salvage business going. And I got more and more involved in the Cobra business with her, and I grow everything I ever do. And next thing was an opportunity to actually buy Super Performance. At that point, we were just a dealer. And in 2004, we bought it. It was a big growth spurt from there. You know, we through all the extra models that we now do, because we now do from, you know, every different Cobra Carol ever built back in the 60s. And people only think of one Cobra when you think of a Cobra, the 427. But actually the slab sides he built more of, and he built more FIAs were done. And of course the Sebring Roadsters were done. And he then developed the Daytona, Shelby Daytona. And from there, it ended up when Ford brought him in and said, no, you've got to race the GT40 for us. And Ford versus Ferrari proved all that. And we built the cars, 36 cars we supplied to the movie for Ford versus Ferrari. And yeah, that's how that all grew. So it's that was 2004, end of 2004 that we bought the company. So what have we got now? 17 years, somewhere around there, 18 years.
Wow.
Wow.
And what today does it operate out of as far as square footage and number of employees?
So the factory in South Africa, which I don't own, but I own all the tooling and the intellectual property rights and everything to Super Performance and Shelby Legendary Cars, because we also build the cars for Shelby. We build all the CSX Cobras. So CSX 2000, all the way up to the CSX 9000, every different edition of shop. The factory has approximately 700 employees. It's about 700,000 square foot, and it's on a 24-acre parcel of land in South Africa. It predominantly builds my cars only. They have a couple of side gigs. They do some machinery that crushes rocks, and they build boats, believe it or not. They build boats that the South African Army and stuff use. They're not very big boats. They 40 foot and smaller, and they use outboards. I don't know too much about them, and that's one of their side gigs, but otherwise everything else is done for me. And then in the U.S., we just have two locations, one in Irvine still, and then now headquarters are in Jupiter, Florida.
Not to hop around, but going back to getting the salvage business, trying to get going in the U.S., what was some of the biggest challenges that you were overcoming there? Was it the big conglomerates working with the insurance companies? Was that kind of like an eye-opening experience, or was it, I guess I'm just kind of intrigued of what was the learning curve from 13, you said, you know, successful business in South Africa, you're coming over here, you're like, I know this shit. I'm fixing to run it. And what was the learning experience like?
Well, I'm a pretty stubborn person, and I hate rules. I try and obey laws as far as I possibly can, but sure as hell I hate rules. And I did it the wrong way when I came to America. So I thought that you just arrive, I'm a businessman from America, I'm going to be a businessman from South Africa, I'm going to be a businessman in America. Well, quickly, the first thing you discover is there's such a thing as a social security number, and which I didn't have. So I thought, well, okay, let me go buy one or get one. What do you do? Well, now you've got to do proper immigration. What for? I'm going to be running back and forth, you know? Anyhow. I started bumping my heads with lawyers and trying to get the green card. And then I managed to get a reasonably good contract from one of the insurance companies, and they were prepared to go with me. And I explained to them all my systems of how I handle salvage, and they were very impressed with it. They were prepared to work with me on it. And then the last step was, you know, of course, they run your social to see, and they said, well, Lance, you don't exist. So what do you mean I don't exist?
I'm right here.
Yeah, here I am. I said, well, you got no credit rating, no credit record. And that was the truth of it. You can't just come and reinvent the wheel and just try and do it. But, so that was not the final, because I didn't give up that easily. And originally we had come to buy a salvage business in North Carolina, and that deal didn't work out. And then I was going to get amalgamated into a very big salvage company. But the guy that ran the business was already nearly 80 years old. He was known as the father of the salvage system in America back then. And his daughter did not want me in the business. She took one look and said, no, she's not getting this loudmouth, used father getting involved in this. This is not happening. So a couple of those things hit me and knocked us, you know. And in the long run, I think what doing the cars that we did, the Cobras, the people that I've met, the most amazing customers that I've got from this, I've got friends all over the world through Superformance. I've been on vacations where you go and visit factories, and you walked into the one factory, and they were one of the wheel factories, Barani, and it's quite a crazy Italian guy. And we start talking, somebody said, no, but Lance, you know, does Cobras, and will the wheels fit the car? He does the Superformance cars. And the guy came and grabbed me. I thought, okay, Italian, I'm going to get knocked behind, you know, get taken out behind the corner or something. And he pulled me in his office, and through the door closed, and behind the wall was the poster of a Superformance GT40. And he said, you know, one day I want one of your cars, I'm going to put the Barani wheels on it. So we discovered that when we went to even Bertone and met the old guys that worked at those places, they all knew about Superformance. And, it was very surprising. So it's I'm glad we ended up doing what we did.
That's awesome.
It's a hell of a brand, you know, for doing something. And I don't want to diminish what you do and call it a kit car, but to be able to take something that's a replica or, you know, a reproduction, and to have such a high end brand, it's pretty admirable, because there's a lot of guys that have tried doing it and nobody else, as far as I know, has pulled it off.
Well, the main reason was, all along when Superformance started, and that was the original owner, was his idea. You know, he didn't want to stay as a kit car company or even as a replica company to that effect. He always wanted to get licensed. And we tried really hard in 2000, 2001 with Carroll. And of course, what ended up was a lawsuit. And 4 years later, we settled with him. And at that, you know, when we started the lawsuit, we'd only built 600 cars, and we'd offered him a reasonable sum of money to license us. And he said, no, not doing that with you. We're going to build our own cars. Shelby's going to build cars. And 4 years later, 2,000 cars later, and we had spent $2.5 million fighting, and he'd spent $1.5 million fighting us, you know, and all that wasted money, and then only to get into license agreement. But the idea behind the company being licensed by, for instance, the Corvette Grand Sport, it took me nearly 8 years to get General Motors to even talk to me about giving me a license to build the Grand Sports. And we got it, and that's when we developed the Grand Sport. The GT40 was exactly the same thing. It was a five-year program and a lot of negotiation with the owners of the GT40 trademark. And, you know, they had even been in negotiations with Ford back in 04, 05, when the 06, 04, 05, 05, 06 GT came out. And Ford did not manage to get those negotiations and get them successful. And they never got the GT40 name for the car. And it didn't really need it, because it wasn't a GT40. It was a GT. It was a bigger car. But yeah, we did come right and negotiate, and we are the only company that can put a GT40 P series number on our car and call it the GT40. Sapa is the company that owns Sapa GT40, own the trademark, and they're pretty strict, and they go after anybody that tries to put a GT40 name on. And that's what we've done with everything. And of course, with us building the CSX Shelbys, there was nothing Carroll hated more than people saying his Shelby Cobras were continuations or replicas. They were new Shelbys. That's what they are. That's been the difference.
That's interesting. I was going to get to that. I was doing a little show prep before, doing a little reading and stuff, and I wanted to ask you about that as much as you're comfortable with talking about it. But the blurb on the website and stuff like that, it's basically 2001 Shelby sues Superformance. 2004, Superformance and Shelby enter in an agreement, and it kind of skips a lot in between there. And like you just said, did this lawsuit from Shelby against y'all come from you approaching them to get licensed?
Yeah, partly. And of course, we were building the cars, and you were seeing them every day. And then I always used to say, Carol, and we love Carol. He just was the most incredible man. But one of the problems he had in business is he had a lot of people around him, and I call them fox terriers. They were little fox terriers that were chewing his ankles, biting his ankles. And they would say, look what this guy's doing. He's making all this money on you. Look at this guy. He's making money. And that used to, even when we were in business with him, I had wonderful days with him. And then I had days when he would call up and be screaming at me. And I'd realize somebody has bitten his ankles again. And I would have to now find, okay, Carol, what did they say? What have I done this time? And he said, blah, 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 blah. And then he would explain it. And he was fine. He was fine, and it was over. But there were a lot of little fox terriers that didn't like what I was doing, the fact that I was doing it, and they thought they could do it or they should do it because they'd been friends with Carol forever, and there was a lot of other companies that were building Cobras, and they tried to take over what we had done, and it wasn't going to happen.
That was quite the bit of negotiating for those 3 years or 4 years to go from no, it's not going to happen, and I'm going to sue you to stop you, to hey, you know what? Let's work together and figure this out.
And I'm going to build cars for you. Hear your name.
It's a little more interesting than that. So at the end of the result, the judge Zobel ruled in our favor, but Carol appealed the ruling immediately. And there was one of the mistakes the lawyers even told him. They sued us in Massachusetts, which is a really friendly state to American companies, but he made a mistake on going and opting for a judge. I'm not sure exactly how to explain it, but a judge ruled trial as opposed to a jury. We personally think if he had a jury, they would have ruled in his favor. Anyhow, the judge Zobel ruled against him, and we managed to prove our case that we weren't copying his cars. We could show enough differences on the Superformance cars. We did the exercise where we brought in outsiders. I can't remember those days, cost us a lot of money, but there were at least 40 or 50 people, and we took a Honda, Toyota, Mazda, whatever was available at the time, took all the badges off them and parked them. The same little things that look all the same. And we said to the guy, well, what is this one? And they walked, some would say, that's a Honda, that's a Toyota. That's a Honda. They couldn't get it right. So there were enough differences between each one of those cars to prove that our Cobra looks the same, but it was different. The fender flares are slightly different. And that was one of the reasons that we won the trial. But there's a lot of other things. Anyhow, Carol appealed and requested a jury trial. And now we're done. Yeah, these bunch of South Africans are selling little old man's cars. And we
got to lose. Poor old guy. Yeah.
The guy that was running the company, Superformance. So this timing was all, I bought the company straight after the lawsuit was won. The guy running the company at the time goes and has a heart attack and ends up in hospital and has a four-way bypass. And when he's recovering, he gets the telephone and he called Carol. He says, look what you've done. You put me in hospital with a heart attack, and Carol actually had a tough spot for that. As he was a heart transplant patient. And he said, Ronnie at the time said, come on, Carol, we got to sit down and negotiate. Look what you've spent on the lawsuit or look what we've spent on the lawsuit, and we will pay you off. And that was part of the reason that Carol came together. And, myself had done a lot of negotiations with all the people under Carol and kept saying to him, Carol, now Superformance is at 2,000 cars. If you'd taken money instead, you would have saved your $1.5 million and you would have had over $1 million in royalties. So that's when it started making sense to him that we weren't going to go away and we were just getting stronger and stronger. So we would carry on fighting. And he was, You know, Ahmed admitting a lot more than was ever brought up, but he was pretty broke at the time. And to be truthful, we were broke. we could not afford to carry on with this lawsuit. And
what a crazy story.
That's a challenge. And then I go buy the business, and within days, within 6 or 8 months of it, a couple of the dealers that were upset that I got the business and not them, and they wanted to buy it. They didn't believe somebody would pay for it when it was just come out of a lawsuit, the possibility that Carol could sue again and all that. So they started suing me. And so there was another year of lawsuits biting the old dealers. And we just get that sorted out. And, you know, we were doing well at the time. It was before the big economic crash in 07, I believe it was 07, 08. We were building close to between 40 and 45 cars a month and shipping them. And as I said, then that happened. And we went down to our worst year was, I think, end of 08 to 09. We only sold 80 cars for the whole year as opposed to 40, 45 a month. So we've had some fun challenges.
Yeah, that is that's like the definition of perseverance right there. That's a rough start.
too dumb and stupid to give up.
Basically, as soon as he stepped foot in America, it's been like, you know, another kick in the balls after another kick in the balls
Right as you walk through customs.
Yeah. Welcome to America. Spread your legs. How about this? How many other dealers were there like Hillbank at that point in time selling?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, about six. There were six dealers approximately, yeah. The one big dealer had really controlled the sales. He had, you know, those days the company was broken up into areas and you were only allowed to sell into your territory. And of course, with the advent of the internet and all that, that was the most stupid system. So when I took over, I opened it up and I said, look, if you prepare to travel and try and sell cars anywhere in the country and do car shows, you know, that's, you should get the deal. You shouldn't do all the work, or have a guy from North Carolina visiting California and walks in and sees your car, he's going to be all excited and buy it. But if you can't sell to him, he's going to go home, forget about it. It's not going to happen. And it was a silly system. So that they sued me over getting rid of areas and all that type of stuff.
That was what I was going to add.
They actually first boycotted and never ordered any cars. That was trouble because I had 40 of them arriving, 45 of them arriving a month, and they had to go somewhere. And then the two big dealers stopped ordering and to draw me out. But I found ways of selling them.
Were you selling direct at the time or just through dealers?
Yeah, I was. I have a separate company that I've owned since my dad started in South Africa on the hill next to the bank and called it Hill Bank. And when I came to America, I brought that name across, and that's my dealership. So I had to use Hill Bank to sell worldwide. I mean, Hill Bank was selling Cobras everywhere you could imagine. And that's why they sued me. They sued Hillbank for selling cars out of area.
Gotcha. Who was it? Wasn't that Jesse James that said you're not really successful or you haven't arrived
until you get a lawsuit?
Yeah.
Until you get sued?
Yeah.
Because nobody's suing anybody that's not doing anything like.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
You're not big enough for ripples.
Look at it. I was going to ask you, what was some of the main, I mean, you came from both ends. I mean, like you said, Hillbank was your dealer. You were buying from Superformance. You've obviously knew a lot about the inner workings of the company as well, but you were also on the other side. Then you buy Superformance. You're looking at the struggles probably you went through as a dealer. What were some of the things that you knew you wanted to change immediately? And what are some of the things that you had, seeing both sides of the fence, did you kind of, you know, have to address or change?
Well, the big thing was the areas, because as Hillbank, I had a couple of trailers and I was traveling around the country doing these shows, and it was so frustrating. You had Good Guys show, for instance, and of course the guys come from all over the US to Good Guys, and you spend a half a day or a couple of hours talking to a guy, and then all of a sudden he says, well, I'm actually from Louisiana. And I said, and then I know I can't sell him a car, you know, I've got to take his name, pass it on to the dealer in Louisiana and walk away. And there's nothing more frustrating when it's an 85 degree day, hot as hell, and you spent this much time. And so that was the big issue that I changed. What else can I think of? I've actually got my wife sitting here. She runs a brand of business with me. Well, we did a lot more marketing. You know, they didn't market. And when they owned Superformance, when Hi-Tech owned Superformance, they never worried about marketing and all that. They left all that to the dealers. And so we of course, like marketing. And that was a big change. And we added, of course, a lot more models. You know, we went from a Cobra and a Daytona at the time. And then we developed GT40s and many different versions of the Cobra, and we developed the Grand Sport.
That's crazy.
That is wild. The marketing definitely, that was apparent from the outside looking in, because years and years ago, like I had a friend, remember we did some work on his Cobra. It was in here. That was like 2000 early.
Isn't he also in the salvage business?
Scrap metal business. Yeah. That was early 2000s. And I remember it's like, what is Superformance? You know, you'd have to go to find information on them. You kind of find these little dealers. And I think it came out of Ohio somewhere.
Yeah.
Today, I mean, now you see the logo. It's a very hip brand. You know, it feels very relevant.
It was foreign and almost like grassroots motorsports back of the catalog kind of like
thing. Exactly. Yeah. It felt a little weird. Now, everything looks hip, relevant. You see you guys at SEMA. Just a great presence. It's like, I want one bad. These guys know it, and they're probably waiting for me to. Phil's nervous, I think, about having you on here because I've been eyeing a GT40 for.
It's been 2 years now.
Yeah, quite some time, and I'm hemming and hawing all the time, and I'm like, I think this is the year, it entices you more to buy it because it feels. Feels real. It feels
well. The presentation is everything. I mean, like you said, you talk about Barrett Jackson. I mean, your guys' booth and string right there at Barrett Jackson Scottsdale. I mean, one, location is fucking amazing, and number two, everything's laid out. You've got a great sales staff. All of the cars that you're bringing are looking amazing. Everybody's very friendly, and it brings that further level of legitimacy of like, oh, it's kind of like buying a car. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You know, you've been in this industry long enough. We've been in it long enough to know that there is a learning curve to the customers, and then a larger hill for us to climb as manufacturers to kind of legitimize it, what we're doing, because it's not the standard. Ford does all the marketing. You go into a dealer and it's like, it's an F-150 just like everybody else has. This makes it to where like, you guys going to be here like in a few months if there's a problem or like, what do I do about it? And that's all way it's always been, you know, and especially when you're dealing with a price point of like this, those guys generally are a little bit more, you know, mostly discerning with their purchases, you know, so they're going to like be like, I'm just not buying this from a bunch of fucking kids building hot rods
like us.
Yeah. This is going to be like a real thing. So there's a lot that thought to be said for that of what you've done with the business for sure.
No, thank you. It's been uphill battle. And of course, along the way, there have been so many of these Cobra manufacturers that have gone out of business, and people's deposits are gone. And, you know, the famous Mustang builders, Eleanor guys and all that disappeared, and a lot of people lost a lot of money. So, we were up against those challenges.
Yeah, so you've kind of legitimized it and cemented Superformance as the Kleenex of the industry, kind of. You know, you're the name brand at this point, and that carries an insane amount of weight. It almost legitimizes some of the other guys, maybe to a fault, that it might be a Superformance car, or everything now is a Superformance Cobra.
Yeah, and the fact that you can get that they're documented in the Shelby registry, I mean, is that's something, because then it's not a replica anymore. Like you said, it's a continuation car, you know, that's a completely different. I mean, it's just a couple words, and it seems very simple until you start like actually thinking about it and digging into the fact that it is a recreation, but it's not cataloged or even appeared, by the owners as a replica or anything. Yeah. It's its thing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I know I'm not saying it right, but
no, I get it. Oh, as you started looking at, you said marketing, rolling out more models, was that an easy decision? It is simply the GT40 is a natural progression. That's the next car we're doing. What was the thought process on what comes next, right? They had two models for years and years and years. So how do you follow that up?
It went, as I said, it went from the Cobra and then the Daytona, and you know, we had a lot of time with Peter Brock. He initially discounted us and said, I'm not having anything to do with the kit car company or anything like that. And it took a lot for us to convince him. And he did eventually go to South Africa. And then when he saw what we were doing, you know, became part of the team. And he developed and designed the car for us, the future Daytona, the one we build now, the 93-inch wheelbase. And all along, he wanted a 93-inch wheelbase from Carroll back in the 60s. He didn't want to put the body onto a little FIA, well, a slab side at the time. But anyhow, you know, once that worked and the GT40 was always a dream car for all of us. I mean, that you know, that's a car we had posted on the wall and stuff like that. But we knew it was going to be a really difficult car. And we'd seen other companies, you know, that went with a space frame kind of a thing or a stainless steel type monocoque with a fiberglass roof and all that. And we'd known all along we want to do this car exactly how they did it back in the 60s with the pressed steel panels, with the spot welded joints, you know. Everything had to be correct. And it took us meeting with all the ex-old employees at FAV, Ford Advanced Vehicles in England, spent time with Holman and Moody, Lee Holman, and some of the drawings and blueprints and stuff that he had. The other guy's name's gone out of my head now, but he helped us with a lot of stuff with the GT40. And it's a very slow process. Jim Price, the owner of the factory, is an absolute perfectionist. He'll drive anybody crazy, and he's a reader. He reads book after book after book on anything to do with cars, and the guys who behind him, the guys who developed him. I can't take any credit for that work that's done at the factory personally. It's just, you know, I'm a driver and I want it to happen, but these guys are the guys who did all the hard work and figured everything out. And, you know, he did travel to the UK, spent a lot of time meeting with owners of original cars. And we eventually did get an original Mark II because we came out with the Mark II GT40 first, which is always known as the American GT40. That's the car you see in the movie that won the race in 1966, first, second, and third. It was a Mark I, but Carroll changed the body to get more air in because he put the 427 big block in, so he had to get more air in. So he changed the rear clam. He also changed the angle of the nose. He put a slight. If you have a Mark II and a Mark I staying next to each other, you can't even notice it really. But you know, you guys would, mm-hmm. And most people won't. But there's a steeper slant on the nose on a Mark II, and that gave it more downforce because it was the car ran 226 miles an hour back in 66. Wow. I mean, it's mind-boggling that those guys were fast. And then I've always known, you know, that the next car, we hadn't done the Sebring cars, and they were only four. It was actually two Sebring cars, but Carroll raced it four different colors and with four different drivers. So it changed color and spec, and it was Dan Gurdy. That's the Cobra that he won in. Ken Miles, Dave McDonald, Dan Gurney, Bob Bonnerant. So we then came out and we did a special run of only 15 Sebring cars. But at the end of the day, we built a couple extra because once Dan Gurney was still alive at that stage, wonderful man. I had such wonderful conversations with him. And he said, Lance, I got to have one of these. So we arranged with Shelby. They traded an extra number, and we built a car for Dad. And then there was another special request from a very big car collector that he doesn't want known. So we built another one. That was a really special car that we did, the Sebring Cobra. You can have a look it up. It's interesting. And, it just when you carried on there. But my passion was to do the Grand Sport all along. Yep. I was totally a Chevy guy when I lived in South Africa. And so not a Ford guy, believe it or not. And became a Ford guy here in America.
You bought the right company to start. Right.
The
Grand Sport was an interesting one when I saw that come out, because that was one I always said to myself, why has nobody recreated the mid-year Corvette? It's one of the most beautiful cars ever built in the history of the automobile. And when that came out, from the outside looking in again, I said, man, it's going to be a huge hit, right? It was interesting to me that you chose the Grand Sport versus just more of a replica of the factory, just a big block 427 or a 63 split window coupe. Is there a reason for that, or just fit the brand?
Easy to explain, really. It's all about money. At the time when we brought that car, when we were doing the mid-year Corvettes, you could still buy mid-year Corvettes for 30 to 60,000. You know, this I'm talking 15 years ago almost. Sure. Well, 13 years ago. So we could, and we, anything we sold at the time, we'd have to sell what we call a roller minus engine and transmission, as we sell them now, would need to be between 40 and 60,000 to recoup the money it cost to build the cars. And so that was not going to be possible. We weren't going to sell anything. And the thing is, we wanted to bring out the car that that wasn't well known. I mean, to say it's famous, it wasn't well known at the time. There were only five originals. They really only raced for 1 year because GM pulled the plug on support. They raced after that, but they raced in privateers' hands, and that's when they got all flared and you know, because they had a racing group five, I think it was at the time, and the cars were way faster. So they had bigger tires and they flared the fenders. So the original Grand Sport that won against the Cobras in the first races until GM pulled the plug was, you're right, looked just like a 63 Corvette. But the Grand Sports, they were all converted, flared, and two of them had the roofs cut off and became the Roadsters. So we had to do that car and round two frame car, which wasn't the same as a regular 63 Corvette or anything like that. So we had to do that car. And that, you know, the originals were, even at that point, they were worth $3-4 million. Now, of course, they're probably worth $10-15 million or more. So we knew we were copying a car that had a lot of value. You couldn't just go buy one.
And that, were the round tube frame, was that original to that design?
Yeah.
I've always wondered that. I mean, we manufacture, that's one of our more popular chassis that we manufacture, is the mid-year Corvettes. And we, you know, duplicate some of the factory contours. But seeing that as a chassis builder, I was like, I wonder why they do. I'm very familiar with that car. I just never saw what was underneath it.
Yeah. No, originally he did that. And, you know, it's quite interesting what he did, August Donovan. And, you know, to win in racing, unfortunately, you have to cheat and not get caught. And if you can not get caught, you will win. And nobody even knows. But if you look at our Grand Sport, it's 7/8 scale. It's not the same size as a 63 Corvette. And he did that back in the 60s. He saved over 200 pounds by bringing the car out at 7/8 scale. Nobody managed to notice that.
I've never noticed that either.
Yeah, that's it. And I'll tell you, it's actually a funny story. We got the blueprints from Bob Ash, who owned all the stuff at the time. And I bought a whole two storage lockers full of parts that he'd made, because he restored three of the original Grand Sports, but worked on all five of them. And he had made copies of every bit of the parts, plaster Paris molds of the body and the interior and stuff. We bought all that from him. He had a complete Grand Sport body, the very thin one, because it was very thin. The Grand Sport, the race car, came in at 2,000 pounds. So you got an idea that the 63 Vette is about 3,200 or 3,300 pounds, somewhere around there. You can correct me. I don't even know. But I know it's over 3,000 pounds. And the race car was only 2,000. And that's all the stuff that August Duntop did. Anyhow, we build the first Grand Sport, and the car ships and arrives here in America. And I get in the car, and my arm is bashing the door, and I'm not comfortable. And I'm like, what is going on? Call the factory up. You guys screwed up. You did something wrong. This car's not right. We can't fit up. I've got owners. I'm not an exceptionally big guy. I'm only 210 pounds. I've got 250-pound owners that I want to get in this car. And I said, well, you guys. So they went back, and they looked at the door panels, and we tried to see what we could do. And we made some changes to the door panel and stuff. But your arm bashes the door. And then we discovered we had copied that car too perfectly. We copied it at 7/8 scale.
You took a car that in its like factory configuration is already a little too small
and then
for most people to drive. Yeah. And then you shrunk it, right?
Yeah, we're bigger. Well, they never picked it up. You know, race car drivers those days weighed 165 pounds. And, you know, those guys were slim and slender. Yeah.
That's awesome.
And I can imagine we did a lot of 32 Ford Roadster rollers years ago when the hot rod stuff was pretty popular. And it seemed like the smaller you make the car, the bigger the guy is that wants to buy it and sit in it.
Every time.
All right. So we'll bring out a 61 Cadillac And like a guy my size is like, yeah, that looks good.
5'7", 150 yeah, right. pounds.
You bring it up. 6'2", 350 He's like, I want to fit in that Model A. Not going to happen,
we
buddy.
We see him walking up to the GT40. That's the guy. We see him coming along. You can see him a mile. He's coming. He's going to ask to sit in the GT40. Oh, yeah. No, God. That's not going to happen. Yet we have, believe it or not, there's a little more room in that car. That we're, so we have done owners up to 6'4 in height, but you don't get a full GT40 seat. You get a pad. You get a pad that shapes into the car, and it's not too uncomfortable. It's, if you take the seat out, you'll see the body has that shape. So you, my one installer is a big guy. He weighs about 260 pounds, I think. But he's only 5'11", but he's very fat. And he builds them and he test drives them afterwards, but he pulls the seat out. It pulls out very easily. And he sits in them with no seat and drives them around.
Yeah, I was actually shocked. I came close this year. I came close to pulling the trigger.
You came real close.
At Barrett-Jackson. So I would have done it
if Phil didn't say
yeah,
no.
I never want to bother anyone. I'll never sit in something if I'm not like genuinely interested in it and wasting somebody's time. So I actually sat, there was two there. There was a blue and white one, and then there was a golf theme car.
And okay.
So I sat in the, I mean, thinking about a 250-pound guy climbing in, interesting, but surprisingly, like, they were seemed like they were configured differently with the pedal box. One had a...
Yeah, we could adjust the pedal box.
Yeah, one had like a overhead cam Ford motor with a newer GT Trans-X, and there was more nostalgic, but... Man, you sit like one. I was like lost in it. It was huge. The other one, you sit. You know, it was configured nicely. Yeah. So for a little car and sitting on the ground, I mean, it's impressive. Like the size of a dude that can fit in one of those.
Didn't know where you're going with that.
We'll check with the guy that's going to buy. Like for instance, we just sold Wayne Taylor from Wayne Taylor Racing. And he got a Mark II from us. So we, and he's a short guy. He's really short. So we had to do a different seat and bring the pedals all the way forward for him. And he's fine in the car. But it's normally the opposite. We're always having to get the pedals. The pedal box was adjustable in the GT, the original GT40 also. We put the exact same system in that they had.
I don't want to dig too deep or pry too deep, but I am generally interested in, so you said, you know, you always wanted to bring the Grand Sport to market. You wanted to do the Grand Sport. You know, is that an idea, conversation with High Tech? And at that point, it's like, yeah, we're going to do this. You have to give them an initial order. Do you have to get dealers on board? Who's footing the bill for doing all this prototype work, specifically on the GT40 we're talking about? Yeah. I mean,
commitment.
Yeah, it's a commitment. And I mean, obviously, everybody that's on board believes in that it's going to sell, but at the same time, somebody's got to pay for it in the interim.
Well, to give you an idea, you've meant to start with the Grand Sport. When I said to Jimmy, okay, Jimmy, I'm bringing this Grand Sport project to you, he said, hell no, I am not good Chevy in this factory. That's not going to happen. No Chevy. He's totally a Ford guy, absolute Ford guy. And it took a lot of convincing. I said, Jimmy, I'm doing it. Otherwise, I'm going to try and find somebody else to do it. But I'm building this car. And you built all the cars for Superformance. You know, I bought the company from you. So it took a lot of convincing. And yes, I raised money to do it. The one thing, to do this all in South Africa was a lot cheaper. I will say, back in 2008, when we nearly went out of business because of the sales, the factory was in a lot of trouble. We were all in a lot of trouble. And I was thinking then, well, yes, the opportunity. Roush was looking for work. Everybody was looking for work. And I said, well, look, Roush, you start with the Mark III Cobra. That's my Cobra that we sell the most of. And I'll bring the tooling from South Africa. So firstly, met with them all and they said, No, we don't want you to bring the tooling. Just give us a car. We will tool up and make our own tooling and do everything, which makes sense. And you guys would want to do it that way too. Now I'm talking about 2008 to 2009. I don't remember exactly. It's Lance, you'll get two prototypes and it's approximately $4.5 million. That's what I wanted then. So, you know, for me to do a car in South Africa back in 2008, 2009, there's a whole lot less than that. A whole lot less than that.
Wow.
So, and I think it would be quicker. you know.
So you seem to be a stickler on all the historic accuracies on all these cars. What was the catalyst or the reason to start switching into the modern drivetrains in it? And did you have any holdups on putting all the new Coyotes and fuel injection into these cars, or was that just kind of brought on by customer wants?
You know, it's partially customer, but my install show, I don't own the install shops in America. Those are owned by privateers. You know, the way the business is set up, we're not allowed to sell it with an engine. So there's an install shop problem. And a lot of these installers are, you know, crazy, interesting guys. They love to try new challenges. And as these new engines came out, and of course the crate engine group, you know, with GM initially was the leaders in this, and then Vinci Ford started, and Roush coming out with the engines. Fuel injection was a natural. You don't have a smelly garage and, you know, all that type of stuff. Much as I love a good four-barrel carburetor, there's nothing like it. And unless you can put two four barrels on it, it even looks better. But the fuel-injected engines made a big difference. And now with the Cobras putting in Godzilla engines and Coyotes and stuff like that, all of a sudden, we had a Coyote Cobra that we were developing for low volume, you know, guys probably know all about low volume manufacturers act. I got involved in 2015 with Senator John Campbell and went right through until finally got that happen. The only problem is once it finally got approved, the timing was too late. We sold out, you know, so I've got no additional inventory to go put into low volume and spend the money on developing a low volume car.
That was great segue. It was my next question.
yeah. Well, it's almost in line. So the low volume, we did get very far with it. We have a Mark III chassis done with the brand new Mustang engine, transmission, and the catalytic converters all built in. We had to change the frame. We had to do a whole lot. We were right at the point where we were going to now develop the body to fit because it's different. It's not our regular ladder tube frame that worked under a low volume car. And of course, then we got another deny, you know, when it got put off and put off again and put off again. So that all went to back burner. But one of the test car we built and we took it to SEMA, it was supposed to be displayed at SEMA, put a Coyote in, 6-speed transmission. And one of our older guys, Bob, you love that I'm mentioning this, he's probably 75 now, jumped in the car. And he drove behind the trailers, so he didn't get over 65. That's about as fast as they got. But I think we ended up with 26 mile to a gallon Cobra. And you don't get a 26 mile to a gallon Cobra. It's just an unheard of thing. And that's how good the modern engines are, what I do love about that. Low volume would have been wonderful. But at the moment, to go and start retooling for low volume cars when we are currently sold out until 2025, for what the factory is building. Wow. We can't take people off the line to do that. That's
where insane. I was going to ask you is, as of right now, today, in mid-2023, where is anything at with, you know, Low Volume Act, HR 22?
It's all done. It's all approved. Sue Performance is registered. We have our VIN number. All I got to do is build the cars to the regulations. The regulations are written and done. Yep. You will be self-regulated. So it's not a case of that you have to build a car and then take it to somebody to approve it. It's if you do it according to the regulations, it's taken that it's approved. If they come and do a test or if they pull one of your cars off the street and see you haven't done what is in the regulations, then of course you've got fines and problems coming. I'm not going to say it's difficult at the moment to build a low volume car if you follow the regulations. And it is difficult with our kinds of cars because they're so much smaller and they are insisting on the complete drivetrain out of a 2023 model vehicle. You can't use a crate motor, you can't use an aftermarket catalytic converter. All that's got to be in some, but there's no crash testing, there's no you don't need stability control and ABS and traction, even though we're going to have all that in the low volume car. We had planned traction control, that was all planned for the car. Today, if we had to do a low volume car, you know, we started messing with electric, and I was the biggest anti-electric car guy that you could ever get. But, you know, you just can't stay behind. You just got to, and we did our first electric Cobra 2 years ago, one of my installers came to me and says, Lance, I'm going to put electric drivetrain in a Cobra. I said, no, you're not. Not in one of mine. Forget about it. It's never going to happen. I'm going to die and say I've never driven an electric car. That's what I want to say. And yeah, he spoke me into it. I sent him a rolling chassis, and he built a Tesla drivetrain in it. And with the first test run, he smashed it. To give an idea, this thing was just, he was, at the time, he had over 1,600 or 1,800 pound foot of torque going to the back wheels at 1 mile an hour. And he's a guy who's drag raced VWs and stuff in the old days. He said, Lance, that car just caught me out. Anyhow, got the car done, finished, and I came down and drove it, and I was hooked from that moment onwards. If you know, I don't know if any of you have been in a Plaid, the Tesla Plaid, or anything like that. You're not racing. If you're racing against a gasoline car, you're not racing against him. You leave the scene of the race while he's thinking about trying to race. There's every other piston engine car I've ever raced, the two of them jump away and they race. They go down the road and one starts pulling away. The electric car just leaves the scene.
I just don't want to hear that.
I'm with you. I get it. I've heard the stories. I've got buddies with them. And the same can be said for Lycra or yoga pants on a man. They're super comfortable and they're super supportive.
You're not going to get us.
You hear people making that art, but at the same time, I'm still not going to, you can convince me that it's the most comfortable pair of pants that you'll ever put on, but I'm not going to do it.
If you carry on talking like that, I'm going to have to ask my, Deborah, bring me a Bud Light.
Cheers. The EV stuff comes up all the time, and I feel like I use the Cobra as an example of like what not to put an electric motor, and only because it is that experience.
You
of
guys
the side
gotta,
pipes.
You drop it, you know. So I won't sell it now. I've had it 2 years. I've had many offers. We're building three more. There's customers that are paying crazy amounts of money to have. We're finishing an all-wheel drive Daytona. That's the one we want to take on the Plaid. We think we can get it to the 1.7 second, hopefully, because of weight. We're going to build the car and bring it down to about 2,800 pounds with only roughly a 150, 200 mile range. But it's all about to get that quarter mile time. It's going to be all-wheel drive. We finished an electric GT40 in England. A company did one there, and that's coming to America. It's very impressive. Of course, nothing with a piston engine in that class or stuff can run with that GT40 on the quarter mile. The Cobra ended up weighing only 2,450 pounds, but what I've only got 125-mile range. But it accelerates so fast. You can look when you later on, just look up Superformance MK 3E. Is it? What is it called? Blake. MK3E. Yeah, MK3E. And it's the three little lines as a three, Roman three. But yeah, I've had drag strip, messed with kids with Roush engines, 700 horsepower Mustangs and all that type of stuff. Rolling, give them a rolling start, let them start getting into the torque band of the car, and it's the same thing. It doesn't race the car. It just leaves the scene of the race. It just gone. Sorry, so quickly. I used to hear from customers that I'd taken for test drives over the year. It goes back 20 years. They always talk about, man, my neck was so sore the next day after you took me in the Cobra, and I could never understand what that was all about. Well, after the first day of testing of the Superformance Mark 3E. The next morning, I woke up and I couldn't move my neck. I thought, what the hell's going on? I did it to myself. That car, it hurts you. It hurts you. It hurts your neck.
Are you electronically controlling the way that you roll out the torque and acceleration to put the power down? Because that car could swap ends pretty quickly.
No, that's how it was when he first finished it. No. He's done a lot of work on the programming of it. It's now got a reasonably lengthy accelerator pedal. You can actually go down a quarter and the car feels normal. But from halfway, all sorts of shit's going to start happening.
Damn.
Wow.
And it's the first time. I'm a guy who loves donuts, and I'm forever doing donuts in our parking lots with the Cobras, and I can just sit there and spin the thing around in circles. So I get in this car, and I'm naturally want to do a donut for the camera. And if you see the video, you might be able to pick up. It was my first absolute screwed up donut. I went in, it spun around, it came around once, and then next thing, the car stopped. It slowed down to almost a stop in the turn. The tires were spinning so fast, there was zero traction to cork to help make the car spin around. And then I couldn't see where the hell I was because it was just smoke everywhere. So I actually slowed down. And it looks impressive. I'm coming out of the ball of smoke. But I didn't know where the hell I was. And the car stopped spinning around. It stopped spinning around. I've never had that happen. I don't know of anybody that that's happened to. You just expect while your foot's on the gas, it's going to keep spinning around. Well, it didn't. It had nothing to make it with the tires. The tires were probably spinning at, they estimate, 18,000 RPM. So,
how does the EV side of things apply to the low-volume production vehicle standards that NHTSA wrote with current model year propulsion?
Well, that's the exciting part. It doesn't. So you can just put whatever you want in because the current year they're talking about is for emissions. You have to have current year engine emissions. Well, there's no emissions from electric motors. So you can build it with any electric motor you want. And you know, on a low volume, you still have to take account for EBAP, very, very simple EBAP system, but it's still EBAP. And of course, the catalytic converters and all that stuff you got to think about. And you have to have that the same gearbox. Now you're completely open. A low volume car with an electric drivetrain is a no brainer.
Is it actually going to be viable for the combustion side of things for guys to do it? Like you said, current model Euro, it's fine. Do you want to go out 2023 Silverado V8 and, you know, their downpipes and cat and full exhaust and boom, we're going to fit it in and we're going to build a chassis around it. We're going to build a car around it. We're going to build 325 to be profitable. Obviously you need to be tooled up and you need to be ready. 2024 new Silverado comes out. They do a different motor and they completely different exhaust.
Yeah, and that is the problem with it. And so we've thrown that out a couple of times. There's an exemption for like 1 year afterwards. In other words, if you've started with one engine, you're good for 1 to 2 years of that engine. But no, you've got that exact. That's one of the problems with going gasoline.
That's a moving target, huh?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
New shit every year.
It was such a great project. And as I said, if it had got approved way back in late 2000, like 2010, it should have been done already. You would have seen a lot more exciting cars from companies like yours and my company building some exciting stuff. You know, maybe only 20 or 30 of each model, but under the 325 limit, we could make a business plan out of that. But right now, that's not going to make too much sense. It's too late.
Aren't there some stipulations too that the car needs to be, you know, a very high percent close to what the original was?
10% of the original, and has to be a car that was built 25 years later, or, you know, 25 years earlier or more.
You say it only has to be 10% of the original, or can't vary more than 10%?
10%, you'd be able to. So that was very roughly written. So, for instance, the 10% rule is it wouldn't be difficult to modernize a Cobra and build a completely different shape looking Cobra. The biggest challenges were companies having to be licensed by, you know, the original manufacturer were allowed. Or if the original manufacturer had abandoned the shape, like, for instance, the 32 Fords and stuff, everybody's building them. So Fords pretty much abandoned that. They could never stop anybody doing that. And that's one of the reasons, if you know about the Ferrari lawsuit for the 250 GTO, and Ferrari actually lost that. And there's going to be some interesting Ferrari GTOs coming up in the future.
How is the case different on the Ferrari losing that one and then Mercedes on the Gullwing?
Money, probably.
Yeah, money.
Deeper pockets.
Yeah.
They both have pretty deep pockets.
Mercedes smokes them.
I think the guys suing to get the shape declared public domain on the GTOs had bigger, deeper pockets, and whereas I think guys wanting to recreate the Gullwing, and we all love the Gullwing Mercedes, but I don't know that there's such a big market for replica Gullwings. Right. But the GTOs, you know, $80 million. Plus car and lots of Ferrari crazy guys at one.
Talking about the licensing, I have to assume that getting the Grand Sport license was probably a significantly easier deal than working with the total Shelby deal on the licensing. Was that a pretty?
No, the end result it was. Initially, as I said, I fought that one. It's close to 8 years that I tried to get it, but it was just a no, and I couldn't get anybody to answer. But I was at SEMA 1 year, and one of the big shots of Ford had retired, and I was just talking to him, and I said, I'd love to do the Grand Sport, but I can't get it. I don't know anybody at GM, and I just cannot get in. He says, well, I've got a friend at GM, and he said, I'll give him a call for you. And he gave him a call, and next thing I got called to Michigan, and I ended up at the licensing arm at the time. And they were a great bunch of guys. They loved cars. They knew Super Performance. They knew the cars, and it went quite easily from there. That body. But up until then, I was just a flat no. I was approaching it from the wrong angle, actually. I learned that later. You got to go to the licensing companies because they normally independent, and they just want the licensing fee.
They just want
the initial sign up bonus that they get. Whereas if you try and do it through people in General Motors, they're like, they don't really want to work. They don't want to take this on as an aggravation.
I've always wondered that, specifically with GM, is I would love to know what the licensing revenue yearly is, because GM,
like everything's an officially licensed.
You can come across a Jeff Gordon commemorative Kleenex box, GM licensed, and it's like, holy shit, everything. It's GM licensed. You pay us for it. Yeah, it's fine. Put GM licensed. Yeah. It's a Ford Mustang diecast, GM licensed.
They got their money.
Yeah. We'd all probably be starry-eyed looking at that. So what's the next greatest, craziest thing? Are you looking at, changing, adding dealers? Are you adding more models? Are you, going to more shows?
We actually, with being sold out, like all this weirdest COVID crap that went on, it changed our industry. And from having inventory in the showroom to now zero inventory, most of my showrooms, and an order book that goes to 2025. So now we've cut back on shows, believe it or not, because it's very frustrating standing there and some guy goes, okay, I want to do it. And you tell him, well, if you're going to put the order in now and you're going to get your car at 20, he walks away. So no, we're doing less shows. Dealers, we've also stopped. We're now at about 25, 26 dealers worldwide. And we stopped adding dealers because of frustration. If you sign on as a dealer now, you'll wait a year plus before you'll get your first cars. So some of the guys that during COVID signed up, I've got a very nice dealer in Indianapolis. This guy retired, was very successful in business. And my other dealer said, he's too spoiled. He's got too much money. He's not going to do well at this. Well, they forget. The reason he's successful is because he worked hard. And he works just as hard in this business as he did in his other business. He gets up at 5 in the morning, and now he's nearly one of the top sales guys. And he's only receiving his first cars now, but he's taken his allocation for every single month and sold out going forward till 2025. So dealers know we're trying not to take more. We've got other models we're talking about. We did get licensed a while ago by Ford to build the GR1, the Shelby GR1. So we that's still in the back burner because we're so far sold out and the factory's so busy. And I've got a couple other cars in the back of my mind that have been worrying me and wanting to do for many years.
Well, it doesn't seem like he shies away from marketing opportunities and doing stuff that's wild and crazy. He's done, how many EV vehicles did he just, talk about? Yeah. I think that a GT40 super performance that's, got a full Roadster Shop custom chassis under it would break the internet. Absolutely.
But you see, Josh, here's the problem.
You're teeing both of them up, huh?
So the problem is that the reason I'm looking at one is because I can't get those cars done when I take on those projects myself. I'm looking at it as like, it's
you just
perfect.
Want to pay the money.
It's perfect the way it is. I want it running, driving, so I can't fuck with it. And I'm going to drive it and have fun with it.
Notice he bought his boat. He didn't.
Exactly. I build it.
I'm super excited that this is on record that he said he would buy it, not fuck with it.
That's what I'm looking for.
He's going to play that on loop.
Do it. It's done right. That's a feather in your cap. I'm a particular son of a bitch.
What does the R&D process look like when you're coming out with a new model? How much time do you guys spend on designing everything? Is it a whole new with all the different Cobra models, is it a whole new chassis, drivetrain, body, everything? Or are you building off of historic models?
You know, we're busy now with a special project to Goodwood Revival, and it's to celebrate the Shelby's 100th centenary, you know, Carroll's centenary, and I think he's Lord or Duke now, I'm not sure, Lord March is backing us, and he said he'll make a little fuss about the whole 100th centenary of Carroll Shelby. So we duplicating CSX 2000, the first Cobra. And everybody thinks that's the first Cobra and all the 289s. Well, they weren't. The cars changed. And this car is so precise that the project is now in its about eighth month. And we had a Cobra. We had a round tube frame. We had the body. We got everything. Why is it so difficult? Well, when you go into the proper records on CSX 2000, the car was different. The car had a narrower flares, it had a narrower body than the regular 2000 series Cobras, slab side Cobras. It ran the inboard discs like the Jaguars do, brakes. It had a worm and sector steering system. It didn't have a steering box. It just so much stuff. So we... The research that's done is incredible, and it's not, and most of this stuff was done way before computers were doing anything. So we've got to find the old written files and blueprints, and then speak to some of the old guys that are still alive, and get the correct information. And I wanted this car 6 months ago, and the guy said we don't think it's going to be ready by the time Goodwood is in November. So we might have to have a stand-in. They're building a second car, which is closer to our car, to be there. But we're gonna launch. I'm not sure how many at the time. It might only be 20 of these CSX 2000s. I've really got people that want one of them. And I might not have it ready in time because that's the detail they go to.
You guys have a harder time finding the information.
Sorry?
So you have a harder time finding the information and, making it like the original than actually building the car itself.
And then, a lot of the people that made those parts are out of business. So you struggle to find the old tooling, and then you end up having to make tooling. There's lots of little aspects of the car. We make all that. For instance, the Grand Sport. Everybody said, Lance, why did you guys go to that effort? You could probably build a better car if we just got a Roadster Shop chassis and we put a C6 or C7 suspension on it and then put the Corvette Grand Sport. It would have been a much better car, driving car, but it wouldn't have been a Grand Sport.
Of course.
And the guys who bought, for instance, who bought the Grand Sport from me, Mark Royce, head of GM, he owns one of our Grand Sports. The director or manager at the Corvette Museum, he owns one of our Grand Sports.
I respect the hell out of that. I really do respect the hell out of that.
The authenticity of the car.
Yeah, it's not the guy. It's not the guy that takes a Corvette and makes a hot rod out of it. It's not that guy. It's a guy who's got a couple of Ferraris in his collection. He's got an Aston Martin. He's got all that. He wants a Grand Sport that is correct. It's got all the warts and all of the original Grand Sport. And so that's why it takes us so long, because we don't just see, well, you know what the hell is modern, when it comes to brakes, we'll use Wilwood brakes and stuff, because that's a safety issue. But we do a GT40 called a tool room copy. And tool room is a term they use in the UK when you actually take each nut and bolt from the original car and sit and copy the son of a bitch exactly the way it was. The color, the thread pattern, everything. And that's how accurate you have to do to call it a tool room. And our tool room GT40 was more than 6 years. We were building all the other GT40s. It looks from far, you walk up to it, it looks like one of our GT40s. You won't see that. But every body panel, the chassis, the steel monocoque is different. There's different parts to it. The wheels they look the same, but they're actually different. There's just differences in the wheels. And we even recreated the old Girling brakes. We went to a company in the UK that manufactures Girling brakes for it. We could put Woolworths on the car for $2,000 and Girling replicas for $10,000. Give you an idea.
Fuck it. Yes, gotta have it.
If you're gonna set out to do something and you've already set your guardrails, stay within the lane.
Yeah. That's, you know, there's replica companies now. I don't use bad language, so I won't name that replica company. And they build very bright looking, shiny things that blind people buy. And I cannot understand why anybody would buy them. But from 100 feet, they look lovely and they look shiny. And but they did it when they went up against me, and they gave me a hard time for my regular Super Performance cars. They actually hurt us. They outsold me for a short while on just the stock Mark III, because at that stage they were 20K cheaper. And I said to people, if you look at the belt line of my car, go to the bottom of the car and take – the bottom of my car has, those days, this was 10, 15 years ago, is approximately $10,000 worth of parts, because we manufacture the suspension. It's not a – we buy the Wilwood brakes for the car. It's brand new steering brake. It's brand new differentials. At the time, we were getting ZF differentials and paying $2,500 to get the old ZF independent. If you took this other company, the bottom of their car was roughly $500. And what they were doing is old BMWs from scrapyards in South Africa. Yeah. They would get all the parts from an old BMW, which you could buy those parts for about $500, and then just sandblast them, clean them, paint them. That's including the brakes. That's including everything. Eventually, they started running out of that supply. But China recreated the BMW suspensions, brakes, and all that for the old small BMWs at less than $500 for the whole lot, and all that went under their car. So I said, I can't build a car. And we thought about it. At that time, we were desperate. Sales were bad, and we said, well, oh my God, the bank said, well, do we do this? Do we just go, we've got the BMW, the Super Performance frame, we will just put old BMW shit under the car, and we can sell it in competition. But we decided, thank goodness, against that.
That was good. That was a good decision. We have had both of them in the shop for service. We've got customers, local guys that just bring them in. Maybe it's an oil change. Maybe it's just, you know, some minor maintenance. So I have put my eyes on both of them, the loud color one that the blind guys buy. So I'm familiar with what you're talking about. And I've got to say, I mean, honestly, when I look at what you guys have done, you look at the undercarriage, you look at the suspension, the engineering, the design, it's impressive. I mean, it's almost like, it almost pisses you off, because you look at it and you're like, man, we're building like the most high-end stuff out there, and this is really fucking good, you know? Like, this looks good.
Right.
The other stuff, I'm with you, man. I get it. What's that?
If you consider in the days that I'm talking about, you know what it costs to do one of your cars.
Of course.
And you take a Super Performance rolling chassis minus engine and transmission, and it really is only minus that, because the fuel lines are on the fuel tanks. And if you hook the battery, the lights, the wipers, everything will work. It's painted. It's got leather interior. And we were selling that for 38, 39, and 40,000 with the wheels and tires on.
It's a
and
steal.
And you know, you can't paint a car for 40,000 nowadays.
Well, no, can, we couldn't.
We can't buy
it.
The materials.
We couldn't look at it for that.
No. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, very, very impressive piece. Everything.
And I mean, could our car be better? Yeah, it could. If I could sell it for $200, it would be better. But even now, we sell it, we think it's a high price, what they're going for now. And that's roughly the average rolling chassis now is $70,000, $75,000. And that's with the wheels, tires, striped body, you know, the whole deal, complete. It's just missing its engine and transmission, because the differential's in, the brakes are in, everything else is done. And you can't do that. I can't do it in America for that.
No, there's no way. But you guys have found the sweet spot of executing the perfect level of fit and finish. Because guys like us that are used to looking at really high-end stuff, we look at it and there's really nothing. There's nothing you'd
hard
pick
to pick apart.
Yeah, it's like it's like, how the hell do they do it for that price? It's beautiful. It's really like
it's the right
paint,
type of car.
Everything.
Too.
Yeah, it's done well.
How many are you doing a year now?
So totally, our number's low, way lower than it used to be, but our company setup is a little bit different. So we're around 360 rollers, as we call it, a year. But we're going up each month. They're adding almost an extra car every month, one of the models. We finally finished the second. We got four sets of tools for Mark IIIs, the regular Cobra, four body molds to do that, because those we build. We can build as many as 16 to 20 of those a month, but we don't. We don't. We because we haven't got assemblers. We have to use assemblers Some assemblers like GT40 assemblers only work on the GT40 line. Daytona and Cobra are the same guys. Grand Sports are a unique, different set of guys who work on the Grand Sport line. and we finish this another, and we do the Mark III R, which is our flashy kind of looking car. And it's got cutouts in the fenders, and it's really popular now. But we were only building one a month. But now we've got a second set of tools, so now there's two a month coming. And the we call them the round frame Cobras. So all the tube frame Cobras are Shelby's. They were built with tube frame. And then the super performance cars are still built with the square tube frame, well, rectangular tube frame.
Well, man, it's been awesome. We got just a couple of standard questions. I know you got to go. I've heard on a couple of podcasts you talked about, you started out as a motorcycle guy. You were big into motorcycles way more than cars. So I'm going to tweak this question just a little bit. What was your very first motorcycle, and then what was your very first car?
Well, I'm lucky to still own my very first motorcycle. It's lying in South Africa. I had to bring it. It was a Garelli. It's called a Garelli. And they called it a monkey bike those days, but it was a little bit bigger than the monkey bikes. And I was roughly 5 years old when my dad put me on it, because he used to have to look after me on a Saturday morning. My mother wanted a break. And he worked in a dealership. So he put me on this thing, kicked it in gear, couldn't touch the floor, and then I would just idle and putt around the dealership. So one day I decided, well, if I pull this lever up, I'm going to get another gear and I can go a little faster. And I did. And it flew forward into a car. And then I got those were still the days when you had disciplined kids, because you whacked the shit out of it.
Yeah.
He first checked the car, saw everything else, and thought I was still alive. And, then he beat me up worse than what the man got.
Are you still reluctant to grab second gear to this day?
I'm still reluctant. I've still got that little Garelli. It's in South Africa. I do intend bringing it to America. And then got involved in motocross. And he always didn't want me riding on the road. He said, you know, I don't want you on street bikes. And kept me in the dirt for as long as possible. My wife's just shouting. I've still got my first car too, believe it or not. It's a Datsun pickup. It was called the Datsun Sunny. They never came to America. The Sunnies never came to America. It even had a transverse leaf spring front suspension. Wow. The little Datsun, so way back. It was 1969 and 70. They only ran the Sunny 2 years, and it had a 1,000 cc engine, and I had to go to the army in this, and I loaded four of my buddies on this little thing, and it's nearly 900 miles to Uppington, where my army camp was, and then I came home on a pass, and my dad gave me a couple of bucks, and he said, well, you want to make it faster, go to the scrapyard, my buddy will give you one of the 1,200 cc engines, that was the bigger engine, but you got to do it all yourself. So right outside the scrapyard, used their cherry pickup, pulled my 1,000 cc out, put my 1,200 in, and went back to the army 4 or 5 days later in that. And then I came home, and he said, guess what, they've got a 1,400 cc at the scrapyard now. I said, I've got to have that. Went back there, and then there was an Alfa Romeo they were disassembling, and it had Webers on the side. So I pulled the Webers off the Alfa, got a friend of mine to weld up a manifold for me and put the Webers on the side of it. And that's the engine it still has in today. And I was 19 when I did that. And it still got that 1400 cc with the Webers on the side, put in outside the scrapyard.
That's amazing.
I'm sitting here blown away, because he's talking about, you know, get there faster. Dad says, hey, you want to put the 1200 in? Put the 1200 in. Oh, hey, here's the 1400. He's going and putting the motor in, puts it in, hooks it up, and he's still making the trip. I've got an 18-year-old daughter that's calling me to put more money on the Starbucks app, because she's and I'm like,
No, I was totally car crazy and motorcycle crazy, and I mean, I fell off going to my license, because I decided to take, there was a very fat, very wonderful off ramp that we had just before the license department. It was a hell of a long sweeper, and I loved it. And I used to get some crazy speeds, but I didn't calculate right that day, and there ended up being a car on the off ramp, and I thought, what problem? I'm going to go past him on the inside, and I hit the white line, and I went through. And I arrive at the DMV, and here my jeans are all torn up and cut and full of blood, and the side of the motorcycle's all scraped up. And my dad takes one look. He says, what the hell's going on? I said, don't say anything. Let's just go. Just get the license. And the inspector came out, and the look. He said, what else? I said, oh, that happened a couple of days ago. He said, well, what about your pants and all the blood? He said, yeah, it doesn't want to stop bleeding, and I still wear the same jeans. I like these jeans. And meantime, my leg was in so much pain. It was, but I got the license that day, and then my dad whacked the side of my head again. Baby. Don't, why did you do that work? And yeah, so I loved my, that was actually one of my bad falls, I must admit.
That was great.
That was a really good one. Based on your earlier conversation and your amount of involvement, I probably know the answer to this, but what was the best car movie and why?
Oh, that's a no-brainer. Yeah. Ford versus Ferrari.
Yeah, I kind of figured it was a toss-up.
It was such an incredible experience. I still got to pinch myself because, you know, I grew up in the south of Johannesburg, and you guys won't know what that means, but you have in Johannesburg, you had the south, you had the north, east, and west, of course. The south was the poorer area. East was also one of the poorer areas, and then west got a little bit better, but the north were where all the wealthy people lived. So, you know, my wife and I both grew, she actually grew up in the east, and she was in foster care, so she grew up real tough. And then for us, we pinch ourselves now to say we were on the red carpet with actors and the cars that were done for, you know, just these two little white Africans from Africa, South Africa. And so, yeah,
that is crazy. Ford,
that's awesome.
The movie was wonderful. But I will say the other day I was here bored and put the TV on and I put Netflix on and all of a sudden Smokey and the Bandit came up. What a wonderful movie.
Yeah.
I sat in that movie. They couldn't get the smile off my face. You got this warm feeling like you've just, I don't know, I've never done cocaine, but I imagine that one. I just felt good after. What a good movie when the men were real, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I just watched it again about 3 or 4 weeks ago with my son. And that's probably my 300th time seeing it. I love Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah. I haven't seen it in a long Smokey time.
And man, it's good.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'll leave you with a motorcycle story. The different things were in the old days. So I wasn't supposed to go on the road, but I did. And my dad ended up, we built a little Triumph Tiger Cub, which was a 200cc Triumph. And I was 12 at the time. Of course, Johannesburg, South Africa, could only get a motorcycle license. 16 was a 50cc and 18 was anything bigger. And I'm riding this thing. And we had a policeman in our area, in a little town. And he was nicknamed Teardrops because he had teardrop sunglasses and he used to chase us and we'd go straight into the dirt and we could get away and get home. But I was on one of my dirt bikes and they were better. And this day I'm riding the Triumph and next thing there's Teardrop as I come out. Did exactly the same as I did, the same path. We cut across through the bush and out the other side. But I put the fuel line on and I wasn't sure how long I needed the fuel line to be. So I just used the full length and I thought I'm going to trim it and, you know, fit it up nicely. But I didn't straight away and decided I'm going to go ride. Well, the fuel line got hooked by a branch and pulled the fuel line off. And next thing, this motorcycle slows down. And of course, I'm stopping. I'm trying to see what the hell's going on. And Teardrop caught me. Came in with a police truck and put the motorcycle on the back, took it to the police station. And I thought, now I'm dead. Now that's the end. So my father comes home. I said, okay, I got to tell you. So the motorcycle, I was caught. And Teardrop got me. And the thing, well, it was so different. I see my dad first. Said, I'll deal with you later. And he goes to the bar, grabs a bottle of whiskey, goes to the police station. He gives the guy a bottle of whiskey. The motorcycle came out and came home. But then, of course, you know, then I got sorted out. The world was, you know.
Yeah, a lot of good life lessons.
Better times,
much better times.
Much better times. Best piece of advice that you ever received?
Best piece of advice. Oh, there's quite a lot of that. I'm just trying to think of something that comes to mind straight away. I mean, you know, definitely live life while you can. Just had a friend of mine just pass away, and you know, very surprising, big, powerful guy, and he's 62 years old. I couldn't believe that. Life. And I mean, you just never know when your number gets drawn. We there's no full-time gig yet. We're going one of these days.
And last but not least, if you weren't doing what you're doing right now and you could pick any other profession, what would it be?
You know, the weird thing is one of the things I did in between was 16 and my buddy and I had a disco, mobile disco. And we would play parties and the how funny, how crazy people go. We'd play parties at the convents and the girls would think we were a bunch of actors or musicians or whatever. And that was a hell of a sensation when they come up screaming and carrying on. And so I always said a musician, you know, would be very cool.
Basically, you want to be a rock star.
I think it's an easier way to make money than what I've done. You know, yeah. When I think how these guys make. And I, you know, people will say, well, why'd you say golfer or is that? You know what? That's a hard job. I know they make a crazy, crazy amount of money, but that's a, I think a musician's an easier job. I just need my back of my wife.
That's too much stress.
We'll leave after this, but you see a lot of wealthy men with good looking women, right?
Okay.
Yes.
But you see just about every musician with good-looking women, and a lot of them aren't wealthy.
That's true, dude. Yeah. I had an interview with Good Guys years ago, and they asked me the same exact question, and that's how I answered it. If I wasn't building hot rods, what else would you do? I'd be a fucking rock star, right? It's easy as that.
We'll get the band together.
Let's do it. I'm going to take you up on that.
Lance, it's been awesome, really. Great getting to know you. I hope we can get hook up sometime at a show or something like that, and maybe have dinner or something like that.
Would love to.
We're awesome. If you guys ever out in Florida, you come visit us. We've got a cool looking showroom out here. And of course, if you're ever in Irvine, you can go see the Irvine showroom. There's never less than 120 to 140 Cobras and stuff standing in Irvine.
Oh, awesome.
We'd love to see it. Yeah. Man, thanks. This has been awesome.
See you soon, man.
Okay. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Big thanks again to Lance Stander. Remember, you can keep up with Lance by following him on Instagram at Lance Stander or at Superformance. Next up. Is nothing.
Nothing. That's it.
Whiskey review.
See ya.
We got to do a whiskey review. That's the next thing.
That's it.
This one.
It's a good thing that Phil's going shopping because we've killed about, well, we haven't killed him, but we've opened every single bottle here and Phil's the only one that keeps showing up with new bottles. Thanks for that, Phil.
No problem. I don't know if this was my best pick. I'm going to be honest. I fought through it a little bit.
It's interesting. It's high proof.
Yeah. It's the fullest full proof I think I've ever drank.
It's got all the proof, many proofs.
Many proofs.
When he poured it earlier before we got started, it was over there. And as soon as he opened it, I was writing some stuff down. I was like, oh, wow, that one's going to be a hot one. Yeah, you could smell it.
It's burning my eyes every time I take a sip.
A little bit of gasoline.
Soon as I took a sip, like the, I guess because of the proof or however it's done is way flavorful, and I quite enjoyed it. Even with the high proof, I'm starting to get to where I'm liking a little bit higher proof.
I dropped some water in mine. I'd put training wheels
on
it.
Probably needed that.
It smoothed it out a lot.
I guess maybe today I was just in the mood for some burn.
You like the Old Elk the barrel strength, barrel proof.
Sometimes you want that.
You want something to just kick you right in the...
Start getting used to some of it, and it tastes like it's watered down, even neat. And
there's nothing watered down about that.
It's 125 proof. That's a hot boy.
I'm on board with what Josh said. I mean, it's probably not something I would reach for, you know, every night, but it's loaded with flavor. Really, really good stuff, but it's hot. It's hot. It burns the eyes as you bring that glass to your mouth. But... all the flavor. What do you think? Who's gonna throw the number out there?
I'm just gonna rank it pretty high. I'm gonna give it a flavor. It's fucking good. It really is.
You're coming right off. I watched your whiskey review. All right, so you're coming off of two, three
bangers
back to back. Weeks of just shit, right? Basically, you're just drinking toilet water, more or less.
Yeah.
Now you've got something. This is a pretty high end. What's the price point on this?
Price point wasn't that high. It's really hard to find.
I'm giving it a 7.5.
Okay, you're just going to cut me off and just throw the review?
You're done.
Keep going. I'm just...
I think it's a $65, $70 bottle. Okay. I'm not ridiculous, but yeah.
High end, decent.
Hard to find any of the... unique 1792s.
Well, you have to read because they all look the same.
They do. That's one of my pet peeves is those damn bottles. It's the same thing.
You look for the barrel. Band color of the band,
right? Same thing with the barrel bourbons, things like that. Change the shape of the damn bottle and make it a little bit unique.
They want to have a congruency and be on brand. And I get it. I just don't like having to like.
I get it, but it's
focus.
Yeah. You look at big different color. Standard one's like a maroon band.
Okay.
Yeah.
But if you don't know what they are, you still have to go and like read. Right. You just see.
Yeah, I mean, it's a daunting task. To look at the two words underneath.
I'll tell you what's number.
Scan for a while.
I'll tell you what's different. What's different is my review. It's a 7.3. I'm going a little lighter because I knew you liked it more than I did, but it's not bad. It's pretty good. I would drink it. Mm. Have to be a special occasion when I feel like something just burning the ever living shit out of my
eyes, mouth, and face.
Knowing this, you have to admit that this drinks like a higher end, even though this is still pretty decent. This drinks like a higher end bourbon. If you blind taste tested,
yep,
the flavor that this has, and you didn't know it was 1792, it doesn't have the prominence, you'd rate this high.
I would. Well, I mean, that's still a pretty good review. I'm not downplaying it. I'm not saying anything negative.
I think it blinds you during the taste test with the fumes coming off of it.
It does do that.
Stack this up next to little stag, George T. Stag.
You're right.
That's a fire breather right there.
Yeah.
I think it's better than the George T. Stag. Yeah,
this one's got a better flavor than Stag.
I haven't had it in a long time. I'm going to go lowest of the bunch. I'm going to go a 7.0. Yeah. Little water helped it out. The training wheels go a long way with
asterisk.
It.
Phil cried.
Phil cried.
Phil cried says too hot.
Call it like I see it. You know,
this overall, it's something you have to seek out. You're not going to find it everywhere, right? It's a
rarity. If you want that flavor, you find Foolproof.
You know what's good for something like that is when you have some friends
marshmallows.
I'm sorry.
What?
Are you just saying words?
Yeah, like a chicken roasted marshmallows and it's a Foolproof. Go ahead.
What's the matter with you? That's a good one. You have some friends over, like, oh, I love bourbon. Drink bourbon all the time.
You like 140
proof? That's great. Because I've got a fantastic new bottle. Mm-hmm. Here we go. You got any ice cubes? No, man.
No.
I thought you should
fresh out.
The ice maker is broken.
We drink it neat around.
No, I feel like for that one you break out the Booker's. It's got the nice wood case.
Oh, fuck that. Booker's is That's like gasoline.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's perfect for that.
Start going back to some of the Booker's. They have like three different a year and
it's
they
like
change
700 proof.
I know. We're gonna have to review it. And see.
All right. It's a buy it though for me.
100% buy it.
So it has a special place in the collection.
Phil gives it a 7.0. Jeremy gives it a 7.3. I give it a 7.5. That's the 1792 Foolproof. I want to bring some of the 1792s from home. Do the sweet wheat. Yeah.
12.
The, 12. The sweet wheat was better than the 12, wasn't it?
You got a fair assessment on the sweet wheat that it's like Noah's Mill. Extremely different. You can't drink it with anything else in that night.
Yeah.
I got the 12-year I paid stupid secondhand price for because I really wanted it to add to the collection. I bought it for like $200.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Did you not get one that time we all got one?
No, I got a Sweet Wheat and I think a Weller 12. So you can only get two, so those were the two that I picked.
You know what we're going to have to do, though, on the next podcast, because it's a unique bottle and we consumed many different liquors on the last podcast with the Viper Chair Boys, the Bacta.
Yes.
Remember to bust that back out.
Yeah, I was excited to try that.
There's a lot going on there.
Yeah. It was good.
The Sissy Whiskey they brought, I think, ruined my palate for that one. It was super sweet beforehand.
It was sweet, but it was
good.
Something different.
Yeah, I'm not saying it was bad, but
are we not going to try the thing?
Oh, forgot about that. I was supposed to get
right there.
I know. I was supposed to get limes. I got the big ice cube.
That's its own. You got to do all that kind of stuff?
It adds to the flavor.
Is that its own thing then?
It's its own thing.
All right, well, we're going to back burner that one.
We do have something special coming up.
What do we got?
We're going to do, we're going to taste whiskey. I'm sorry, oil and whiskey season one. We're going to take all of oil and whiskey season one and put it in our mouth.
And how are we going to do that, Josh?
We got infinity bottles that have came in that we're going to pour.
Bottles or bottle?
Bottles, because we're going to do one for whiskey or season one and one for season two.
So I'm going to lean on you to know what the divide is. Where's the split on season two?
That's after season one ended.
Well, I understand that, but
No, I've got them all wrote down.
Okay.
So I figured you would.
We're going to go through and fill up the season.
I know you're very organized like that.
So we're making basically a Long Island iced tea of season one.
What is this?
Kind of like that. Around the world. Suicide.
What are we looking at?
I've never heard the suicide. I've heard the around the world.
Suicide is the same thing when you're doing
all the things. I was at my son's, I went to a baseball game, and then all the kids went to Culver's afterwards, and three of them sitting there like, oh, try this, and just hit everything on the machine. And I got super excited, like, oh, kids still do the around the world. And they all looked at me like, the hell are you talking about, old man?
I know exactly what you're talking about. Still to this day, if we're sitting in a booth and I need a refill from a fountain drink, I cannot ask Phil to do it for me. Even if I'm trapped, because I know 100% of the time that's coming back with an around the world. That is a little cherry Coke,
and you don't
a
like
little root beer, a little Diet Coke, a little Fanta.
I'm expanding your flavor profile.
Some Lipton tea.
I'll bring it back. I think it's been once he just genuinely did me a favor and filled it back up with root beer.
And I was probably sleeping on it.
Yeah. You fucking gave me an around the world, didn't you?
So I think the season one infinity bottle will be good. Right,
what's the receptacle? What is this? Is this a surprise? Or what is it going in?
A glass decanter? Infinity bottle. Decanter.
Okay. Specifically
made for it, and it's got labels on it, so we'll be able to write everything that was in that bottle.
Josh and his infinite internet research found a pretty badass bottle.
Of course he did.
We're gonna pour it up and we're gonna taste it. Right, you with me so far?
I'm with you.
That's only two things hard to lose.
Yeah, keep going, because I've got like 30 seconds more attention span left before I figured
we would bring it to Columbus. Good guys.
Okay, I'm with you.
For special friends, maybe a little taste.
Oh, good idea.
Yeah. So that's what's happening.
And then where are we headed once we dump these all out into that infinity bottle? Because most of those are like a quarter of the way full.
We can just do a splash. Rows. We have a set amount. We can do like a
might as well make it
ounce of each.
It's just gonna be, we have a lot of friends. It's going to be a lot of people to share this with. What I'm getting at is, though, how are we replenishing this?
Oh, judging by the look on Josh's face, that was not the idea.
We'll have to. We can do whatever. Fuck it. We'll put it in a 5-gallon bucket, pour it in there. Let's go. We will be depleting.
They have all been depreciated.
Significantly. We'll be depleting most of this stock, and we will have to go to Garfield's Beverage Warehouse and Liquor Emporium for a complete restock. However, that's going to need a Garfield's Beverage Warehouse and Liquor Emporium sponsorship or half.
Special coupon code.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe he's got like a punch it card. Buy 10 and the next 60 bottles are free.
Yeah, I don't think so.
No, he does. He's got a loyalty thing.
Really?
Yeah. I haven't signed up for it. I just say no every time.
Great use of it. Thanks again for listening to Oil and Whiskey and Ironclad Original. If you like the show, be sure to leave a rating or review. Like, comment, subscribe. Smash that like
button. Smash it. Check out the new Instagram.
Check it out.
Instagram's looking good, right?
Yeah. It's looking great.
A lot of good stuff. Little excerpts. Some behind-the-scenes stuff. Just funny outtakes.
Some BTS?
BTS.
What the fuck is that?
Behind the scenes. Where are you at on the lingo these days? Come on.
I'm just not hip like you guys.
It's just an abbreviation. Yeah. It's not even that hip.
There may even be an NPD.
We'll see.
See you next
week.